I have a couple of younger brothers, and one of my younger brothers, well, they're both good, strong keepers of the nine commandments. And one of them said, with age comes wisdom, but sometimes wisdom comes alone. Ooh. Well, this brings to mind that wisdom, as they say, is like wine. It ought to become better with age. Well, there was a world-famous French wine expert who was making a tour of America. He was going from one luxury wine cellar to the next in order to recork very expensive old bottles of wine. Because over time, cork can deteriorate, and those extremely expensive bottles of wine then would be spoiled if they let any air through the broken seal. Well, some of these bottles of wine are over 100 years old. They cost many thousands of dollars. You can't go back and duplicate them. And so the French expert was making his tour of America, and he was being interviewed by an American journalist on how risky or scary it was to recork such expensive bottles. And the Frenchman replied, "What is wine anyway, but grape juice on its way to becoming vinegar?" Well, he didn't take it real seriously because he knew this was a natural progression. But wisdom, they say, is like wine. It comes to ripen at an appropriate time. If we look in Cambridge Dictionary, it tells us what wisdom is. It's the ability to make good judgments based upon what you've learned from your experience or the knowledge and understanding that gives you this ability. Ooh, I like the idea of making good decisions. Well, when we think of wisdom from the Bible, we generally think of the book of Proverbs. So today we're going to anchor around Proverbs 30, starting in verse 24, and I've entitled this message, How to Be Exceedingly Wise. How to be exceedingly wise. So if we turn to Proverbs 30 and verse 24, we read something that's easy to look right over the top of. Proverbs 30, verse 24, there are four things which are little on the earth, but they are exceedingly wise. Now, I find it interesting that the word exceedingly is used to describe, in this case, wisdom. Not just a regular portion of wisdom, but a whole lot of wisdom. And I suppose regular wisdom would be something like, don't put your hand on a hot stove. And most of us gain that wisdom early in life. Or perhaps wisdom would be, watch where you're going. And most of us have learned we can get hurt and suffer pain if we bump into things or fall down. In Proverbs 14 and verse 6, and keep your back in Proverbs 30, we're going to come back to it. In Proverbs 14, verse 6, a scoffer seeks wisdom and does not find it, but knowledge is easy to him who understands. Well, a scoffer claims actually to seek wisdom, doesn't find it because they don't allow the knowledge to seep in that will allow them to gain wisdom. Now we have in 2 Chronicles, starting in chapter 1, it's 2 Chronicles 1 and verse 7, we have the explanation of how Solomon asked for wisdom, and then he actually pursued wisdom. In 2 Chronicles 1 and verse 7, that night God appeared to Solomon and said to him, "Ask for whatever you want me to give you." Wouldn't that be a neat thing to wake up at night and hear God talking to you and saying, "What do you want me to give you?" So you think, well, what would you ask for? And verse 8, Solomon answered God. Well, for one thing, I'd be pretty well shaken. But Solomon answered God, "You have shown great kindness to David, my father, and have made me king in his place. Now, Lord God, let your promise to my father David be confirmed. For you've made me king over a people who are as numerous as the dust of the earth." Well, how much dust is on the earth? It means there's so much you can't count them. From where he looked at, there were millions of people. And he was responsible for. Verse 10, "Give me wisdom and knowledge that I may lead this people. For who is able to govern this great people of yours?" So he acknowledged and understood it was a big challenge. He needed something beyond himself. In verse 11, God said to Solomon, "Since this is your heart's desire, and you have not asked for wealth, possessions, or honor, nor for the death of your enemies, And since you've not asked for a long life, but for wisdom and knowledge to govern my people, over whom I have made you king, therefore wisdom and knowledge will be given to you. It could end right there. Wow, what a nice thing to be. And I will also give you wealth, possessions, and honor, such as no king who was before you ever had, and none after you will have. Gulp, that's a lot. Nothing before that matched the splendor of Solomon, and afterwards it would not either. So Solomon acknowledged this gift of knowledge and wisdom from God, and he actively then pursued wisdom. In Ecclesiastes 1 and verse 13, Ecclesiastes 1:13, we can read his mindset. Ecclesiastes 1:13. And I set my heart to seek and search out my wisdom concerning all that's done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised. He wanted to understand everything. Don't you ever have a 3 or 4 year old kid in the house? And they constantly said, why? I'd like you to do X, Y, or Z. Why? What do you, you know? And they're constantly asked. And that's a test there. What are they trying to gain? Knowledge and by osmosis wisdom. It isn't just a nice thing to get, but wisdom is a responsibility that Christians must pursue. If we flip to Acts 6 and verse 3, Acts 6 and verse 3, we have an example of this. Therefore, brethren, seek out from among you 7 men of good reputation, full of the Holy Spirit and wisdom, whom we may appoint over this business. So they were needing deacons, and they said, there's got to be people among you who can do this job, who can do the function. And they wanted people with good reputations, full of the Holy Spirit and wisdom. Well, so there's a practical application. So let's go back to Proverbs 30 and verse 24. And I want to explore what God called exceedingly wise. Exceedingly wise. And if we went to Proverbs 30, verse 24, let's go to the next verse, verse 25. Proverbs 30, 25. And here it talks about ants, those little crawly things. The ants are a people not strong, yet they prepare their food in the summer. Now, I suspect that many of us have, somewhere along the way in life, have seen how ants work. We've watched them. They're tiny. They seem to be constantly busy. Do you see a lazy ant? They're always doing something. I remember in elementary school, some classrooms would have an ant farm, a special glass enclosure, very narrow container with glass on both sides. And the enclosure was only an inch or two thick, but you could see it, the whole ant colonies in all of the little chambers and where they stored bits of food, where the queen would have the eggs and how they would tenderly take care of them. The proverb here notes that the ants were busy preparing food in the summer. The ants could simply relax and enjoy the warmth and the produce of the summer, yet the tiny ants prepared for the future, for such a time when it wouldn't be warm and when food would not be plentiful. Perhaps some of you have read the book entitled Aesop's Fables. The book is about a collection of stories attributed to a Greek slave and a storyteller named Aesop from about 600 BC. Each of the stories in Aesop's Fables has a moral or a principle at the end of the story. And one particular story is entitled The Ant and the Grasshopper. And the fable describes how the diligent ant worked during the summer to prepare food for the winter. But then a hungry, lazy grasshopper begs for food when winter comes, and the ant refuses the grasshopper. The situation sums up moral lessons about the virtues of hard work and planning for the future. I know as a young man, I recalled I had a failure to plan ahead, and it caused a serious problem for me. And one of my brothers helped me out of the jam. but not without commenting to me, "What have we learned, grasshopper?" Gulp. Well, in other words, if you go through the hard stuff, but if you're going to be a grasshopper, you probably had best learn and be more diligent like the ant next time. Now, the ant was busy doing what was important, making good decisions today to enjoy a better tomorrow. The Cambridge Dictionary defines maturity: the state of being mentally and emotionally well-developed and therefore responsible. Maturity is also defined as the ability to recognize the benefits of delayed gratification. Now, delayed gratification means making a choice which limits the ability of getting something now for the pleasure of being able to have something bigger or better later. So delayed gratification is important. Now, there was a Stanford University did an experiment. They call it the marshmallow experiment, the Stanford marshmallow experiment. And what they did is they studied a group of 4 to 6 year old children, and they were given a marshmallow and left in a room for 15 minutes. They were given the choice. They could eat the marshmallow now, but if they waited the full 15 minutes, they would be able to have 2 marshmallows. Well, some of the children were able to wait 15 minutes, and other children just weren't able to do so. Well, the study didn't finish there, though. The researchers continued to study those children as they developed into adolescence, and they found that the children who were able to have delayed gratification, they were held onto that marshmallow so they could get the second one, they were psychologically better adjusted, more dependable people, more self-motivated, and as high school students, here's the objective measurement, they had significantly better grades. With the latest study on these exact same participants later in life, it showed that the characteristics have remained with the individuals for life. So delayed gratification is a choice of an individual. You can choose to have something now, or you can choose to have something bigger or better at a later time. Delayed gratification improves our willpower and helps us to reach our long-term goals faster. So let's look back now at the lesson of the ant. What did the ant do? The ant, they practiced the principle of delayed gratification, getting important things done today so they can enjoy a more comfortable future. That was Proverbs 30, verse 25. Now let's go to Proverbs 30, verse 26. And this is about the badger. The badger. In Proverbs 30, verse 26, the rock badgers are a feeble folk, yet they make their homes in the crags. Now, to me, it seemed like an impossible task to make a home in a pile of rocks. Yet the badger was able to make his home where other creatures could not. The badger digs under rocks and finds a home, a defensible home that serves to protect its young. Now, badgers don't have strong arms and legs, so they can't lift and move the rocks, but they search for open spaces among the rocks, and they use their feeble strength to dig the dirt out from between or among the rocks. As a boy on the farm, I would come across a hole in the ground where some creature will have dug a tunnel down into a den. And sometimes the hole was near a pile of rocks. Now, I grew up on a farm in Minnesota, and farmers would pick up the rocks that were in the field, and they would pile them on the edge of the field. And the under the rock pile made a convenient place for badgers to dig a hole, and they were protected because nobody else was going to dig a hole through the rock pile. They dug under it. And while there's badgers in Minnesota where I grew up, the neighboring state of Wisconsin is well known for its badgers. In fact, the nickname for the state of Wisconsin is the Badger State. In the 1820s, iron ore miners, and of course, northern Michigan has a lot of iron ore, as does northern Minnesota, but the iron ore miners, they dug holes in the sides of hills to remove the iron ore. And those many holes in the Rocky Hills reminded people of badger holes, and hence Wisconsin became the Badger State. Well, what's the lesson we're to learn from this badger? The lesson of the badger is they find opportunities where others cannot. and then they establish their own security or safety by taking advantage of what other people see as obstacles. So the badger has a different lesson than what we've learned from the ant. The ant, we learned delayed gratification, and the badger, to find opportunities where others cannot. The third animal here in Proverbs 30, starting in verse 27, are the locusts. In Proverbs 30, verse 27, the locusts have no king, yet they all advance in ranks. Now, locusts are flying, jumping, crawling creatures similar to a grasshopper. In the summertime, during grain harvest season, grasshoppers somehow knew that the grain was ready to harvest. And as a boy, I suppose I was 5 or 6 years old, went along with my dad. We're harvesting oats on the nearby neighbor's farm. And so I rode along with him. I didn't know it at the time. He was getting me out of the house to make my mother's life easier. But I only learned that as a parent later, many years. So I'm going along with him, riding in the grain box, harvesting oats. And the old neighbor, when they unloaded the oats, he would be going through the oats that were coming out and picking out the grasshoppers and putting them in a quart jar. And I'm just a little kid. I'm going, you know, Dad, why is he picking out the grasshoppers? I couldn't think of an earthly reason why this old man, probably younger than I am now, would be picking out grasshoppers. And my dad explained it simply. He's going to use the grasshoppers as bait for fishing. Oh, well, the grasshoppers were important, but they came around during grain harvest season. Now, it was during the Great Depression in the 1930s. There was a terrible drought in the Midwest. Lack of rain dried up the land. Several states were so dry that in the Midwest, the place is referred to in the history books as the Dust Bowl. Not only was there a lack of rain, the crops that did grow were eaten up by swarms and clouds of grasshoppers. My dad was telling me that the grasshoppers ate every green thing in its path. Now, some of you have raised chickens, and it's quite interesting to watch the chickens when they chase flying insects or they pounce on an insect when the insect lands. Well, my dad was explaining, because he had relatives that came up from Nebraska, from the Dust Bowl, and he was explaining that the chickens delighted in eating the grasshoppers, and the chickens ate so many grasshoppers during the Dust Bowl and when they were being invaded that the green grasshoppers, the chickens ate so many that the chicken eggs turned green. We're talking the inside and the outside of the chicken eggs. The shells were greenish, the egg whites were greenish, and the egg yolks were greenish. He said it was hard to eat the green eggs. Now, I suspect that the author of the Dr. Seuss children's books must have grown up during the Great Depression because he also had that green eggs experience. Now, the affliction of the locusts was also one of the 10 plagues during the time of Moses and Exodus from Egypt. In Exodus 10, and starting in verse 12, the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt for the locusts, that they may come upon the land of Egypt and eat every herb of the land and all that hail is left." So first came the hail, smashed everything down, and then what? Comes the locust. Verse 13, so Moses stretched out his rod over the land of Egypt, and the Lord brought an east wind from the land all that day and all that night. And when it was morning, the east wind brought the locusts. Well, let's see. If the wind was blowing at 45, 50 miles an hour, maybe even 60, and it blew all night, so those could have come from 1,000 miles away. When it was morning, the east wind brought the locusts, and the locust went up all over all the land of Egypt and rested on the territory of Egypt. They were very severe. Previously, there had not been such locusts nor shall there be ever after them. Well, that's a lot of locusts. Now, the locusts came in swarms or clouds, riding the wind, and they ate every green thing in front of them. And then, again, they were later carried away by the wind. I remember my dad was telling me about the grasshoppers in Oklahoma. There were so many, and to Kansas and Nebraska, so many, it would kind of darken out the sun. It was just big, huge clouds of them. Well, if it was worse then, you can really imagine how bad they were. In Deuteronomy 28 and verse 15, in Deuteronomy 28, the children of Israel were warned, "But it shall come to pass, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments and his statutes, which I command you today, all these curses will come upon you and overtake you." And then it goes through a number of things that when you read those, you say, ooh, this is ungood. I'm not going to go for that. But down you go, drop down to verse 42 in Deuteronomy 28, verse 42. "Locusts shall consume all your trees and the produce of your land." Whoa, that means they're going to eat every green thing around. Yet it's interesting that the locusts don't have a commander. Locusts don't have a boss to tell them what to do. There's no formal organizational structure. The locusts don't have job titles. They don't have job descriptions. They don't punch a clock, a time clock. No one tells them when to go to work or what to do, and when they're done, to when to go home. The locusts simply march together, advancing in waves or ranks, eating everything in their path. Now, I have a small flock of sheep, and when the sheep graze, they often line up in a row next to each other, side by side, and then they advance as they're eating. Their heads are down to eat, and they advance in a line. It's really quite remarkable to see that they chew the grass like a lawnmower as they're moving along. And I can't help but think of the locusts who also advanced row after row after row, eating everything in their path. Well, what is the lesson of the locust? It's that everyone participates in a cooperative manner to get the job done without someone having to tell them what to do. Isn't that what every employer wants? People voluntarily do what they need to do. They all work together cooperatively, getting the job done without somebody telling them. So we have that example then of the locust getting things done in a cooperative manner. Then we go to Proverbs 30 and verse 28. Proverbs 30 and verse 28, and we read about the spider. And I see some of you shrink back when I say the word spider. In Proverbs 30, verse 28, "The spider skillfully grasps with its hands, and it's in the king's palaces." Now, I don't know about you, but I really don't like spiders. I can intellectually understand the importance in our entire ecosystem, but I really don't appreciate sharing a lot of space with spiders. Not in my bedroom, not in my kitchen, not in my house, and not in my car. But there's a few things that we should know about spiders in order to understand how to be exceedingly wise. We should learn about these things. Well, most everyone fears and hates spiders on sight, and they're some of the most impressive, well-equipped animals on earth. They are a very high-order predator. They're built for killing and survival. Ooh. Their amazingly adaptive bodies make them some of the most successful carnivores or flesh eaters on the planet. They are on every continent and every environment. There are over 40,000 known species and probably some that we haven't even discovered yet. Well, how many spiders in the world? It's estimated there are about 1 million spiders per acre of land on Earth. Now, some acres will have more, some less. If it's in the tropics, the number is thought to be about 3 million spiders per acre. And what is an acre? 44,000 and some square feet. Okay, that's a lot of spiders. Well, what value is it? What are we going to learn from the spider? Well, a spider has insect control. Spiders eat more insects than birds and bats combined. They should be considered one of humans' best friend because they control insect populations. Now, I read once about if you had two houseflies, a male and a female housefly, and they reproduced unlimited reproduction on day one. They just started reproducing, and all of their offspring reproduced and weren't killed, and then all of their offspring reproduced, and this continued for 1 year. The question is then, doing the math, how many houseflies would you have at the end of 1 year if nothing ever ate or killed any of those houseflies? And the mathematicians did the math, and they calculated that one pair of houseflies, if left unfettered and they reproduce freely, would cover the earth 4.5 feet deep. Well, so there are natural predators for insects, and that includes the spiders. Now, some spiders use silk to trap their prey. That's you know, they protect their young, they build nests. I know that when you have a spider web, and I know that my chicken barn door, there's always a spider web in the door. And if I open the door and it swings inwards, that I better clear it out before I try to go in. I'm going to have a face full of spider web. The or as they say, if you ever want to watch, take a video of somebody doing karate practice, just watch where some unassuming person walks into a spider web and they're acting in every direction, just trying to, because nobody wants a spider to be crawling on them. Some spiders, they're able to, that don't spin a traditional web, they have a sticky blob on the end of a silk line. They call it a bolus. And they attract their prey, like a moth or a fly, with scent, pheromones. And they lure their victim, and it's like swinging a rope. But on the end of the rope is a sticky blob. And then they nail that that fly or insect, and then they draw it in. Sort of like a fisherman casting out his line and then pulling it in. Indeed, some spiders are actually fishing. They fish. This was new to me. There are 109 arachnid or spider families that catch and consume small fish. This is not comforting to me about getting into the water with these kinds of creatures. 18 species can catch fish. Some can swim, dive, and some I've seen walk on the surface of the water. There's a certain surface tension they can run across. And indeed, there are a few spiders that can swim underwater. And they can submerge for 20 minutes to an hour. They kind of create a diving air bell that they can continue to breathe. Some spiders use hydraulic power. You know, when you see a backhoe and a tractor digging out earth and such, and they use hydraulic power to that articulating arm, they use that same kind of hydraulic power, fluid in their system, pumps into their legs, and allows them to expand their leg muscles rapidly so they can jump and fling themselves in a far direction. And then spiders have multiple pairs of eyes. It's not just your mother with the eyes in the back of her head. It's the spiders that can look in many directions. Now, most spiders look through the world by the sense of touch. We call it tactile sensation. But they're covered with these tiny little hairs over their body, so they're very sensitive, and they can sense sound vibrations. And wherever they're standing, whether they're on the ground, standing on a floor or a leaf, or in a spider web, they can pick up those vibrations that come through the air. Some spiders even have bristles they can shoot off, like darts. Now, most spiders are aggressive and they live alone. But there are about 40 species of spiders that have societies, like ants and bees. They're social, they have groups. And most of the social spiders live in the tropical regions of the world, where there are lots and lots of spiders. And they have colonies, and sometimes these colonies are big enough to take down birds and bats and other large insects. Another reason not to spend too much time there unless you're prepared. Some spiders, they don't just spin webs. They roam the ground and they build traps, wolf spiders, tarantulas, and some even build tunnels and funnels and burrows in the ground, trap their prey who go in and can't get back out. There's a funnel web grass spider because they construct their webs in tall grass. Now, as a farm boy growing up, when we'd make alfalfa hay, cut the field off, we'd leave stubble. And as the stubble just started to grow right afterwards, and you'd see acres and acres of the land that was just cut, and then the dew would come out in the morning, and the sun would shine on the dew, and it would glisten on all of these spider webs, and the whole field is filled with spider webs. I mean, it's glistening everywhere. You wouldn't know it normally when the sun comes out and evaporates the dew, but they are there. There are some spiders that are big enough to catch, capture, and eat birds. More comfort for you, I know. Spiders are generally about 12 inches across. Now, they're very lightweight, 2.5 ounces. And then there are Goliath bird eaters. Spiders or arachnids have external skeletons. We have our bones on the inside. They've got their structure on the outside. So they shed an old skeleton, and then the new one growing underneath is stretched, so they can grow bigger. Well, there aren't many mentions of spiders in the Bible, but there is a particular instructive verse in Job 8. In Job 8, starting in verse 13. Now that we have a little background on spiders, in Job 8, starting in verse 13, "So are the paths of all who forget God, and the hope of the hypocrite shall perish, whose confidence shall be cut off, and whose trust is a spider's web. He leans on his house, it does not stand, he holds it fast, but it doesn't endure." Relying or leaning on a spider's web, how's that going to work out for you? And that's what it's like when it says, if they forget God, they're putting their trust on a web, a very flimsy web. They're not sturdy. And so if we put our trust in a spider's web and lean on it, what will happen? We'll likely fall. Now, spider's web have their places. They rely on time and chance and not as a sturdy structure. Abandoning God is like trusting a spider's web, and that will not have a good outcome. So then what should we draw from this lesson in Proverbs 30, verse 28? The spider skillfully grasps with its hands, and it's in the king's palaces. Notice that the verse does not stop with the mention that the spider skillfully grasps with its hands. The verse goes on to say the spider is in the king's palaces. It doesn't matter how sophisticated you think your status in life is, whether it's a king or whatever. It doesn't matter how well you think you built your house. Even if it's a grandiose palace, spiders will work to find their way in. Many years ago, as a consulting manufacturing engineer, I had the opportunity to assist with the construction of a computer disk drive manufacturing plant. The manufacturing plant, as you can imagine, had to be super clean at all times. It had to be free of dust, free of insects. And what the plant designer did was to install several heating and air conditioning units on the roof. So the air pressure was in the center, they had a series of rooms, concentric. A room in the middle, and then a room outside of that, and a room outside of that. So it was like a series of donuts. It started out small and got bigger. But they put the air pressure into the center room, and they call that the clean room, because that had the highest air pressure, higher than outside. And then doors would open to the next room out, and so forth, so that if any dust or any insect tried to get in, it would have to fight the air pressure. And so that's what made that super clean room very clean. And in fact, that's still done now in computer manufacturing plants and assembly places. Because the air pressure on the inside, because in order for the insects to get in the building or the dust, they would have to go fight the air pressure to get in. Now, of course, spiders could still go in because the air pressure, because they're just going to crawl along. But you see, there's no motivation for them because there was no insects in the building, and the spiders did not have an interest if they couldn't get fed. Perhaps you know the expression about your computer having a bug in it. You know, your computer, you take it to an expert to have it debugged. Well, originally, it's because the insects often like a place that's warm and dark, and that would be like in a computer housing, thus interfering with the computer operation. So we're looking about this spider, how we can ask this question: how diligent are we to use the resources that we have? Are we as persistent as the spider who can get everywhere? So the lesson from the spider is to use our resources, however limited, however weak, to accomplish our objective. So when we read in Proverbs 30, God gives us four scriptural examples of what is exceedingly wise. Proverbs 30, verse 24, there are four things which are little on the earth. Wouldn't think much of it because they're small, generally inconsequential. But they are exceedingly wise. Not a little bit wise, but extraordinarily wise. Verse 25, the answer of people not strong, yet to prepare their food in the summer. You see, the lesson from the ant is that they practice the principle of delayed gratification, getting important things done today so they can enjoy a more comfortable future. That's one of the four components here to wisdom. Verse 26, the rock badgers are a feeble folk, that they make their homes in crags. Well, the lesson of the badger is that they find opportunities where others cannot, and then they establish their own security or safety by taking advantage of what others see as obstacles. Verse 27, the locusts have no king, yet they all advance in ranks. Well, the lesson of the locust is that everyone participates in a cooperative manner to get the job done without someone telling them what to do. And that's one thing I just love about the church, no matter where I go, is that people are jumping in to do things, don't have to be told. They jump in and want to have that same objective of making things happen. Verse 28, the spider skillfully grasps with its hands, and it's in the king's palaces. So the lesson from the spider is to use our resources, however limited, to go wherever we need to do whatever we have to do to accomplish our objective. Well, it's our Christian responsibility to learn wisdom and to make the most of what God has given to us. And God has provided the examples from Scripture that can help us to understand what it means to be exceedingly wise. And those examples are from what he calls the little things on earth. So as we read through Proverbs 30, we can follow that example of Proverbs 30 about those four little things and learn how to be exceedingly wise. Oh, I do have two other little announcements that I should